The following podcast discusses sensitive topics related to death, loss, and grief, which may be triggering for some listeners. If you find these subjects difficult, please take care of yourself and feel free to pause or skip this episode. Listener discretion is advised. Hello and welcome back to Passing Perspective podcast, where we dive into the many perspectives on death, grief and everything in between. This is episode 2, where we're going to focus on loss, culture and healing. I'm your host Donna, and today I'm very excited to bring you a conversation with a guest you might know from TV, actor and performer Patrick Robinson. So Patrick has been a staple on British television for years, from his role in BBC's Casualty to his time dancing on Strictly Come Dancing. But today, we're stepping away from the stage and the screen to talk about something more personal. Loss, grief, and how his Caribbean roots have shaped his experience with death in his family. This is going to be a powerful conversation, so let's get started. Right, Patrick. Thank you for coming and talking to me today. And I know you as Mr. Patrick Robinson, and anybody that has seen you on TV will know you. But they haven't, well, we don't know you as you, this side of you. So before we go into the conversation that I want us to have, can you tell us a little bit about your background and where you grew up?
Hello, Donna. Yeah, I'm Patrick Robinson, and I was brought up where I started to become an actor and went to drama school early 80s and then got my first job the mid 80s in Stratford-upon-Avon, and that was the beginning of me sort of leaving London, really.
Leaving London to travel for your work?
Well, work took me away from London, which was great as far as I was concerned, and it took me to Stratford-upon-Avon. Yeah, I came back and did another year in London with the shows with the Royal Shakespeare Company, and then I went out again, and then work took me to Bristol in the early 90s. Took me to Bristol when I started doing Casualty for the BBC, and I subsequently moved out of London and was very happy to do that. And then my now ex-wife, we decided to move up to Stratford-upon-Avon, where her parents were living, well, near. And I've been up there for about 25, 26 years. And now I'm living in South Wales, in near Barry.
Okay, so I'm just going to take these off so I can hear you properly. So you're growing up, obviously you were brought up probably in the Afro-Caribbean community.
Absolutely.
So what is your heritage?
I am West Indian. Mm-hmm. Both my parents are Jamaican. But I was born here in England. Well, not here, we're in Wales right now. In the UK, so yeah. I was born in Southeast London. So the heritage I have, obviously, is West Indian, but obviously born here in the UK, then I have British citizenship, and of course, you think English as well. So there's quite a few boxes that I kind of come under that you could tick. But yeah, that world where you're sort of in between, not quite here, don't belong quite there.
What do you remember in your community growing up? What do you remember? Did you go to church? Did you go parties? Did you go, like, as a young person?
Yeah, there was all of that going on in terms of the families, lots of West Indian families. I've got heaps of cousins because my father is one of 13 children.
Wow.
And I was one of 7. Okay. Initially. So you think there's quite a few cousins, and obviously, you know, when you're young, your cousins are your first friends.
Yes.
As it were.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there was lots of different ways that we would hang out, and one was Sunday school, and of course, you know, certain families would go to church regularly, you know, and it was a kind of mix and match, basically. It depends of who was very, very, you know, really religious, and those of the West Indian community who weren't so on the button with that. And so for my family, we weren't so much into the church stuff. There was other friends and other cousins that were.
So was that auntie, you know, that
it was always
you worry when you go to their
absolutely,
house?
Absolutely. You know,
pray before you eat.
Yes, exactly.
So, like I said, we're going to have a little conversation. I'm going to ask you some questions, nothing personal, and this is just opinion-based, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know there's a stigma, yeah, in the community, in the Afro-Caribbean community, in most communities, when it comes to talking about death or dying, mm-hmm. or even grief and bereavement. So what I'm talking about is what we deal with before, during, and after, you know?
Yeah.
So, and I don't just mean when someone's dying, I mean before somebody is dying, like mm-hmm. how do people approach the situation that we're going to die? My nan, she actually had a suitcase under her bed with her with the coffee and clothes and everything in there. Paid for her funeral outright, and all that was done and dusted, right? Because she wanted to make sure she was sorted. I've noticed, working in this industry, I forgot to say that I invited you to the branch to talk to me, that, you know, Ivor Thomas Funeral Branch is just us sat here chilling. And I've thrown this conversation on you. So I've noticed that some people, like my nan from Dominica, she approached her, she sorted it out before she was even unwell.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get people then that we have coming into our office not having a clue where to start.
Mm-hmm.
They're only here now. But even then, it's a lot of black people will go back to the same traditional funeral directors and they don't, you know, kind of browse about, they don't look about. They say shopping, it's not shopping about, but they don't get any other information. They just stick with, you know, so-and-so and co or so-and-so and sons, and they just... You know, and that's how it goes and goes and goes, which is not bad. But I wanna know, why do you think there's a stigma of talking about it until auntie dies or something, even though you know auntie is dying? Why don't people talk about it?
Well, it's probably not that surprising that when you think about the West Indian community generally, they're quite displaced. And in terms of that diaspora basically coming from the West Indies to Britain in, you know, late 40s, early 50s and so on, that sort of flow of, you might say, of emigration, basically, there was a lot of families that were like fractured straight away and never gained that kind of solidarity, if you like, when they did get together.
Okay.
So there was always stuff that we, let's just say, as children, didn't know. And they wouldn't talk about it.
Yeah.
And you could say, well, why didn't they talk about it? Well, maybe they didn't want to relive all the horrors that they dealt with, the double standards and how they were treated. And they believed that everything was going to be good. And so when the offspring of those who came suddenly are sort of quite militant about, you know, authority, and then the parents are like saying, please just don't bring any police to the house, that's all we ask you. You know, I remember that juxtaposition, thinking, well, what is it all about all the time, and why don't I know? And you kind of go, because they were dealing with trying to work, get some money just to feed the children, rather than sit us down and all have a chat.
Right.
So I see it that many West Indian families didn't talk to their children. And they didn't talk to each other.
That's it.
That's kind of what I feel is I don't know, it's something that is, systemic in one way, to do with that whole world where you kind of go, where do you belong?
Mm.
You're not quite sure where you belong.
So do you notice any differences in how the older and younger generations in the Afro-Caribbean community mm-hmm. sort of talk about it or don't talk about it?
No, I find that if they talk about it, then you're fortunate. I have a good friend of mine whose parents looked out for their, you know, he's one of three children. He's the youngest, his sister and his elder brother. And mum and dad did brilliantly by keeping them in tune with what they were doing, even to the point whereby they moved back to Jamaica. And, you know, everything was left for the children to inherit without any hassle. They've signed this, we've told them that, and everything was put in place, and you kind of go, yeah, and you know, at a certain point when I go, there'll be X amount in this account for this, that, and the other. And, you know, I'm like, wow, that's so brilliant. My father didn't do any of that.
Yeah.
My mother passed away a long time ago, and you go, you don't even know why. You know, some of us literally kind of go, why was she in America?
Yeah.
Kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, what was she doing there in the 70s? And ending up dying there, you kind of go, whoa, what's going on? And that is the family kind of, you know, they keep their counsel. They keep there.
But then you'll sometimes get Chinese whispers then, and people...
Well, that's been me. I'm inquisitive. I want to know stuff. And yeah. I'm trying to ask the right aunties.
And somebody will tell you something, and there's a pink elephant involved, and there's a dog.
To synthesize all the information to try and make one kind of coherent narrative about what happened to my parents and how they came, you know. So for me, it's a creative thing as well, because I'm writing about it too.
Okay.
So, you know, it's very interesting. So
what are you writing about?
Well, one of the stories that I've got, you know, me and a friend have written. and we wrote it in the late 90s, so it's nothing new, and it's something that it's many stories in this world. It, you know, features an Irish and a West Indian coming to Britain in the 50s, and their life coming through into, it was then, to the 90s, and their offspring and so on. You know, so that's one project. Another one is my, you know, story to do with me growing up in Southeast London and how that affected everything that I eventually
did.
The backdrop of street hockey, because it's the sporting side of the West Indian, let's say, community that did that predominantly. And it's something I go, yeah. So that's another thing that I'm writing. And I'm not even worried about some of it. Oh, that's a good idea. I might take that. There's many stories.
Do you think avoiding the conversations about death affects people's mental health? Like you said, that you feel like, you know, your brethren, you're lucky that they had it all set with you. But when you get left with things to do, you get left with things to choose and things to just sort out. Yeah. I mean, I know you said you've got a big family. I don't know where you fall in that.
I'm one of the young ones.
Right.
So a lot of that responsibility indirectly doesn't fall on me.
Yes. And that's another thing with black families. You kind of have
the hierarchy.
The hierarchy,
Of the elders, the eldest within the family that hopefully will take responsibility, which I think is fair, unless they obviously can't cope. But then I think, you know, in terms of us all having a say, would be that would be good too.
But in big families, that's impossible.
Big families is, you know, there's always going to be cliques and little factions that are kind of go, I don't agree, well, I do agree, and so on. And I think it becomes something that sticks. Not that there is anything wrong with, you know, everyone, whatever nationality you are, but within the West Indian, you know, Afro-Caribbean, or whichever one you want to put it under, I go, yeah, it's just not communicating. That's the bottom line.
Yeah.
And, you know, sometimes you think, you know, they just don't want to talk about stuff.
That's what I was going to ask you, like, in regards to encouraging open conversations, do you think education could help change the way people talk in the community? Or do you think community leaders could be the way forward, where they just, you know, I don't know, get back to... I don't even know, Patrick. I can't call it. I really don't know how. Because I work here, I'm trying to get more people to talk about it. I've gone to Bute Town to try and do workshops, and it's good, but people are still scared.
I think it's probably going to take someone who's familiar to a lot of people to get them to be interested.
Like me?
Absolutely not. Absolutely. It takes, you know, as sad as it may seem, you know, that the box or the screen that we all, even on your phone, you know, you can be, as they say, these youngsters who are doing stuff online and, you know, become influencers, influencing the masses to their story, whatever their narrative is. So it's going to take someone who's familiar to come with the same message that you're obviously trying to put forward in the communities, to say, look, let's talk about it. So, you know, on every medium you can think of, it's just going to have to be someone familiar.
Yeah.
A few people less familiar.
Influencers and stuff these days.
Yes.
But... not everybody, I mean, especially the older blacker community, okay, so especially the African Caribbean community, the older people, are they on social media? Are they on the internet?
Not really.
So this goes to my next question. Well, it's not even a question, this goes to my next point, right?
Yeah.
You're a man of the media, and again, you said that you were writing a few things and working on stuff, so how do you think the way death is shown, in the media affects how people in the community talk about it? And it could be drama-based, or even, I'm not talking news and reality-based, but drama-based. That's what people watch, EastEnders, you know, those kind of Coronation Street, even Casualty. That's when people kind of get confronted with these things.
Yeah, well, I think in terms of those dramas, yes, you can make a create a story which features people from those communities telling the story of, you know, they don't talk. Yeah, hopefully that's one way of doing it.
Or the implications of when you don't talk, the fallout.
All of that. So you can, it's, you know, if you have one family and they go through that, and then you can see how it filters through, and you can keep telling the story of they don't speak here, and ultimately, yeah, you can feed that in the dramas. But it's, you know,
do you think that'd work?
It absolutely would work.
Yeah.
That's one other way of doing it. That's, you know, another line of attack, if you like, you know, as well as getting the influence.
Yeah.
But yes, and when it as you link them all up, they're all saying the same thing. So, yeah, I think that's a very good idea, getting in the soaps, because millions of people are still watching
yeah.
that, and they're influenced by the stories. If they want to say, that's not my life, thank goodness, let me watch that programme, but that soap, because, whoa, they're having a nightmare there.
So yeah. Tell me something, what's your experience of the Afro-Caribbean funerals growing up? I mean, my father used to talk about, oh, in Bristol, you'll know if there's a black funeral because you hear the drums before you see the people and all of this. Now, we don't get that in Wales. We don't get that in Cardiff. Maybe in Newport, maybe back in the day in Buketown, but I've never seen it in my life.
Oh, yeah. There's always singing. Gospel around the grave.
Yes. In fact, that's the end. Let's go before. So you go to the... How do you find the funeral? So everybody dressed smart. Best
oh, yes.
of the best.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah, absolutely. And
everybody
whatever.
There who's... Anybody?
Yes.
If you're not there, then basically people will be why so-and-so,
yeah,
why is auntie so-and-so?
Well, one of the things that's come and become quite popular, not that I was aware of it when I was young, and funerals, like, you know, I had the first funeral I ever went to, which was ridiculously heavy for me, was my best friend
okay.
who died
How old
in a car
you?
Accident, 20.
And that's the first funeral you went to?
First funeral.
Okay. Bless.
So, yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Even though my mother passed away when I was 16, 17, she died in the US.
Okay.
And obviously I didn't go. And it was unexpected. And anyway, so the first funeral I went to was, you know, obviously a young person dies. Well, there's two. There's Winston and Donald.
It's traumatizing.
Yeah. And so we were all, I mean, I saw him the night before, that kind of thing.
Wow.
Where you see him, see you later, D, and then you come back the next day and he's gone.
Gone. You know? You a minute, gone the next.
Yeah, so you go, so the funeral was a blur in terms of
who was
happened,
there, what was there.
But it was packed. You couldn't get anywhere near the church, you know. And of course, they were always ushering me and a few others to make sure we were all right coming through, and you know, and it was the first time, and I think the only time that I can recall where they had the casket open and you could see, which I didn't expect.
My father had
so,
the casket.
So there you go. So for me, I was like, no, I don't want to see him.
Like, yeah.
I didn't. But
you don't see him dead, basically.
But you don't know that until, and I'm 20, 21, and you go.
That's again, people don't talk about what to expect.
Because they don't talk about.
Because they don't talk about.
So in terms of, you know, it's not even just to do with funerals. They don't talk about hardly anything.
Anything, yeah.
That's the point I'm making. Whatever the subject matter is, obviously going to be very crucial to you in your latter stages of being. You know, you actually are finding out for yourself, which is
what I have had
to deal with. But yeah, that was the first funeral. It was packed. You know, his mother, you know, Doll, you know, may she rest. You know, she was like a surrogate mother for me. She didn't have any legs. You know, in other words, everyone was just, she was beside herself. She wasn't upright and she was howling.
Yeah.
The whole, you could hear Doll.
Mm.
You know, throughout the whole funeral, she was just had her son's gone. She had five children. So that's the middle boy of her children. You kind of go, and she never recovered. I know that, knowing my friend's mum. So that funeral stuck with me. So every other funeral, I was like, I don't need to go anywhere near anything. And there wasn't any But it wasn't a close relative that died until I was probably in my 30s. And so I'd gone to lots of other funerals where the person wasn't that close to me and I could be there respectfully. And you kind of go, but nothing, no one that close. And for me, there hasn't been anyone closer than that friend who died when I was 20. So every other funeral, yes, I can feel it. And an auntie.
You feel like an observer there rather than your...
Yes, you know, a friend who I've worked with maybe. Yes.
Yeah.
Because he was my, you know, my closest buddy at the time. And, you know, he was gone. And you go, still kicks me in the...
That's the thing.
Solar plexus.
Strong-ass black men don't tend to go and get bereavement support. And even for losing a friend, people wouldn't think, oh...
Hey, excuse me, Donna, bereavement what? Hello? Hello, police, is anyone hiding there in the dark? Bereavement castle. See, that's kind of very new. Like so many, you know, things you can see a counsellor, see a therapist, see, you know, all of those things wasn't sort of available. You had to be really in that sort of psychotic madness.
Yes.
Then you'd be called crazy, go to the madhouse up in, you know.
And then you get your help put on you, whether you want it or not.
So, no, all of this stuff is very nuanced now, how people can go, I need some breathing counselling to do with this specific kind of, you know, survivor's syndrome. Mm. What's that? Well, I was in a crash and I was the only one who survived.
Rightly so.
And you go, whoa, that's a niche.
Yeah.
In terms of all of that bereavement. So, yeah, there's so many areas now where we can talk about it. But, yeah, it's still, if the blanket thing to do with West Indian, Afro-Caribbean,
it's all... Yeah, you can't.
They hardly talking about anything.
Yeah.
To their offspring and so on and what really went down.
Do you personally think it's important to talk about it then?
Oh, yeah.
I know we spoke about, like, you thought, you know, somebody was lucky because they had that. Do you talk about it with your family, if you don't mind me asking?
Well, in one way, yes, but not in that great depth. Because for me now, I go, well, I can go, well, that's all sorted out. I've done a will. Kind of go, you know, I go, yeah. And do you know what you're going to do? I go, yeah. So all of those details, I have a good idea. Do you know what I mean? You kind of go...
Well, you know who's going to get your money in your truck, but then who's going to who's going to pay for your funeral?
But that's what I mean. It won't be that kind of thing. Where it will be somewhere where I kind of go, I don't know, no one's going to have to pay for anything.
Yeah. See, my father would have hated his funeral. He had 4 horses, he had everything. He would have absolutely... Because he said, put me on that ash cart, and just get rid of me. And no, we stopped traffic. It's probably because he said that. That's why we didn't do a small, simple one.
Well, there you go. Well, when you've gone, as it were.
He would have hated his funeral. But it's always nice to get it right. Do you know what I mean? And that's why people have funeral grief as well. Oh, I didn't do this. I didn't pick that. She would have wanted that. We ended up buying, like, again, pink elephants and stuff. Not needed. But that's where it comes into it. It's like you're blown away, you know, because you're sad. You're grieving. And nothing, I mean, even when, you know, you're sorting through coffins and stuff, you don't realise it's a business. Yeah, you don't realise that you're flipping 4 pages because your mother or your father were really good. You know, I spoke about this a lot in the workshops, and I just wish people would just, you know, get down to reality and just humble themselves on it. We're guaranteed to die, Patrick.
That's a definite.
It's the only thing we're certain of, isn't it? Let's be honest.
Yeah, and tax, paying tax. There's the 2 guarantees.
Well, as an actor, you know.
Death and paying tax, baby. Come on.
Oh, thank you so much for having this chat.
My pleasure, darling.
So I'd like to give a huge thank you to Patrick for such an insightful conversation, and I'm really grateful for his openness. I think we will all find a lot of comfort and wisdom in what he shared today. And to all you listeners, thank you for joining me for another episode of Passing Perspective Podcast. If today's conversation has resonated with you, or if you have your own stories to share, please reach out. We'd love to hear from you. Remember, grief is a journey we don't have to take alone. Until next time, I'm Donna, and this is Passing Perspective Podcast, where we explore death, diversity, and everything in between. If you've enjoyed today's episode, please subscribe, leave a review, and share this podcast with someone who you might think will benefit from hearing these conversations. You can follow me on social media or visit the website. We'll be back soon with more stories, more perspectives, and more conversations about death and how we live with it.